Welcome to Energy Thinks, a podcast about how the oil and gas industry will lead into the energy future. I'm Tisha Schuler, your host and the CEO of Adamantine Energy. As regular listeners know, I'm talking about two things that are essential ingredients for energy leadership today: having a compelling vision and then executing on that vision. We cover both of those today. I speak with Federica Berra, Senior Vice President for Aviation at BP. I wanted to talk to Federica because she is at the forefront of one of the largest and most ambitious low-carbon sustainable aviation fuel initiatives that's out there. Her team is present in more than 40 countries, and she will tell us about the history and the broad reach of this work: airlines, airports, businesses, the military. Federica has an MS in chemical engineering. Prior to joining BP, she held leadership positions at ExxonMobil, and she is an internationally recognized expert in natural gas, LNG, and the power sectors. You can learn more about Federica in our show notes. I really think you're going to enjoy the conversation we have about what is required to be successful in leading these kind of initiatives. I hope you enjoy my conversation with Federica Berra. Federica Berra, welcome. It's so great to see you. Thank you for joining me on the Energy Thinks podcast.
Thank you for having me. It's great to be here.
I've been excited to talk to you because you became the Senior Vice President for Aviation at BP last July. This is an arena I don't know much about, and I'm hoping you can paint a picture for me and for our listeners about how aviation plays in to a decarbonized energy future.
Absolutely. So like you say, I took over this job last year in July, and it's a fascinating industry. I've had a lot of fun so far. There's something romantic about it. It connects people, it connects community, it supports trade, it supports business. You and I, many years ago, have had a lot of conversations about the link between energy and economic development. And you see it so much in aviation. As medium income increase and GDP, so does flying. Flying for business, flying for leisure. So we see a lot of that. A few words about Air BP, if you don't mind. We are one of the, globally, we are one of the largest fuel suppliers. We are present in 40 plus countries. Air BP itself is one of the oldest parts of BP. We've been in business for more than 100 years with our brand. So we're quite old. We are in 600 plus locations. So we start far out in the east with New Zealand, and get all the way to the Arctic Circle with Greenland and back down all the way to Latin America. We serve all sorts of airports, from the very large one, like Chicago, like Heathrow, down to flying school and very small landing strips. So last year, we did 6,800 flights we refueled, which is about one per 15 seconds. So this gives you an idea to the scale of the business that we have. Obviously, safety is paramount. We deal with all sorts of weather conditions, like I was just saying. But one of our greatest focus and passion is on product quality, on fuel quality, because there is no roadside assistance when you're at 36,000 feet. The industry itself is fascinating because it's also a growing industry. We talked about economic development and growth, and this is a growing industry. Today, this year, according to IATA, we should get back to pre-COVID level. 2019 level with number of passengers. But in the next 15 years, up to 2040, IATA forecasts that the number of passengers will double from today to 8 billion passengers. So that means a lot of additional flying and additional miles flown. And aviation is 2% of the global emissions. But when it comes to transportation sectors, it is 12%. Of the global emissions. So you can see there is a strong case to start to look at how do we decarbonize it.
I love how you invoke the romanticism of flying and how central it is to our identity and connecting us around the world. I had no idea that Air BP was so big and had such an interesting and robust history. And so I just want to keep pulling on this idea of that scale and also the romanticism of flight. Giving up cross-country flights is one of those things that people are asked to do, like give up meat, give up having children and give up your international flights. And people don't want to give up any of those things. And so I'm curious if you could talk a little bit about sustainable aviation fuel. In preparing for this, I know that you have said that it's the most viable option for decarbonizing the sector, which you mentioned is 12% of transportation emissions. And this is all pretty novel to me. And you often hear people say, like, we can't do it. Like, we can't electrify an airplane. But obviously, you are doing it. So can you talk a little bit about what are the market conditions? How do you do this at scale? Explain for us how sustainable aviation fuel works.
Let me talk about the alternatives very, very briefly and why we think sustainable aviation fuel, SAF, is actually the most viable option for medium and long haul flights. So we distinguish between short haul and medium and long haul, and 70% of the carbon emissions come from medium and long haul. So that's where we are focusing and where we're all looking for a solution. For short haul, there are solutions that are being developed. So electric flying actually might be a reality very soon with eVTOLs, electric vertical takeoff and landing. Now, these are very short haul though, because of the battery capacity. So they're going to be more high-end urban transport, at least at the start. And hydrogen is just complexity of hydrogen, and it requires a whole new aircraft. So both of these are whole new aircraft. So actually, you know, the development of the solution is with the manufacturers. I think the reason why we believe in sustainable aviation fuel, in SAF, let's call it SAF from now on, and we believe it's scalable, is because it's a drop-in fuel. Drop-in means that we can drop it into the vehicle, into the aircraft, without any modifications to the aircraft. It is made with bio feedstock, waste oils, waste fats today.
It delivers up to 80% reduction of life cycle carbon emissions versus conventional jet fuel.
That's significant, but it depends on how it's made and what it's made of. And currently, it's a blend. So you don't fly on 100% SAF. We'll get to it in a minute. But you use it as a blend, it's approved up to 50% with jet. And that's due to the technical component and this very tight specification for the jet fuel. I'll get to why 100% is important, because as you know, back in November last year, we had our moment of fame at BP. We did a Flight 100 with Virgin, which was from London to New York. And it was a historical flight because it was the first flight to cross the Atlantic on 100% SAF. And that was the result of a year of work, and a year of work mainly between us, Boeing and Rolls-Royce, testing the perfect formulation of the fuel that we could drop into the aircraft, and that, you know, we tested it with the engines, on the ground engines with Rolls-Royce, etc., and got certification from the CAA to fly. It's been my moment of fame, so I have to mention that.
It was a very exciting moment and also has its own romanticism too, right? 100% across the Atlantic, a year in the making. Yeah, it was wonderful. So please go on.
So let me stay on scaling up SAF. So what will help us to scale up SAF? Well, one thing for the start, as I described it, being a drop-in fuel, it means we don't need to create much of a new value chain, especially since it's blended already with jet. Much of it depends on how it's going to be produced. So a little bit of, if you don't mind, a little bit of education on this. Most of the SAF is produced through HEFA, a process called HEFA, which is essentially processing the bio feedstock through a reactor that does something called hydrotreating and produces both renewable diesel and sustainable aviation fuel, SAF. The feedstock that you can use is grains, sugars, or oils and fats. So oil and fats tend to be waste oils or beef tallow, waste. For grains and sugars, you can use corn or sugarcane or even soybeans. So it is natural feedstock. Now, the key concern that we have today and the regulators have is the availability of this feedstock. So some of the additional technologies that are developing, which are second generation technology, will use municipal waste or wood residue or even just capturing carbon and hydrogen and creating the molecule synthetically. But those are more expensive and, you know, they're under development right now. So one of the technologies we are very excited about and that we already do is co-processing. So this is just running the feedstock through the existing infrastructure and through the refinery. It's essentially uses the kit that we already have with some modifications. So it's highly scalable and it's lower capital investment. So our job right now is to make sure that we make more feedstock available, that we make more production available, and also that we find, you know, the most efficient ways to produce sustainable aviation fuel. And this is where we play a part. So we think co-processing can play a big part here. Because in the end, scalability will depend on affordability, on policy, and on collaboration between all of us in the industry. Affordability, I know this is the tough part to touch, but SAF is not cheap. So it's between 2 and 6 times more expensive than conventional jet. That it depends on how it is produced. The second generation fuel that I mentioned, that is between 6 and 7 times more expensive than conventional jet. So policy will do a lot to define how it's produced and what feedstock, and also help the affordability for it. And the other bit is collaboration. I think Flight 100 was a great example of how we can make things happen when actually we collaborate across the industry, because we had there the airline with Virgin, we had Rolls-Royce and Boeing, the manufacturers, and we also had the Department of Transport here in the UK, we had the Rocky Mountain Institute in the US. So it was a collaboration between all the stakeholders that made it happen. So it's a positive example. When we all get together, progress is delivered.
I think you create such a great picture. I want to recap a little bit of what you said because it was such a tour de force for our listeners. I think why it's so important that legacy oil and gas companies play a leadership role in the energy transition, because so many of the things you articulated are so technically complex and require innovation just at all these different areas, from whether we're having, as you said, a drop in fuel versus a new aircraft, thinking about the feedstocks and the long-term viability, scalability, affordability of the feedstocks, innovating the feedstocks as well, the co-processing capabilities, and then how all of this evolves technically to ultimately become competitive with traditional fuels, or in some way becomes affordable to the consumer. And none of this could happen without, as you said, that collaboration across industries, across the value chain, but also having some like big leaders with a lot of commitment, long-term commitment to what these really challenging problems. I love the picture that you painted and the lessons that I learned in just a couple of minutes about that. Now, there's a lot of technical components, a lot of logistical components. I'm wondering if we could follow up on the idea of policy, because obviously getting to affordability and safety, regulatory, like all the things that make that have to come together for something like this to happen at scale. I'm curious how global climate initiatives, how the policy environment in the many countries you operate, how could this either help or hinder SAF adoption at scale? What are your thoughts about that?
That's a great question. Because policy is fundamental in the energy transition in general, because it provides certainty on investment, it unlocks demand, and then it creates a level playing field between all the players. And for SAF, as I was mentioning, it is fundamental because policy is driving the technology that we use, the feedstock, and then also whether we create this demand, affordability, level playing field among all the players. So there's been a lot of evolution in the last 4 years, I'd say, and the picture has changed for us as well. And we've seen two main regulatory approaches emerge. So the first one is based on mandates. So creating an obligation in the market to supply SAF, this is the path that Europe has chosen. So we are already getting ready for it. We start with 1st of January 2025. We're going to have an obligation as supplier to supply 2% of SAF with all of our jet supply. It goes up to 6% in 2030 and ramps up to 20% in 2035. So you can see over 10 years, this is going to drive a lot of investment into SAF. And it creates a level playing field for all the players with some certainty of demand. Incentives is the other regulatory pathway. That's the one that we see, for instance, in the United States. In the US, if you see the IRA provides some incentives that then can be put together with other incentives like the renewable fuel standards, the RFS, and others. And those tend to challenge the affordability of SAF and take it down towards and aim to take it down towards parity with jet to favor adoption. So it's a more of a market-based mechanism and lets the market then play with that. So because of that, we see the US SAF could be more affordable or cheaper, if you want, than the European SAF. But then there's further differentiation that, again, it comes with policy. So in the US, the choice of feedstock is going to be, of course, waste, like everywhere else, but also biofeedstock, which essentially means agricultural produce, corn, sugarcane, soybeans that I was mentioning before. And it makes sense because the agricultural industry is so strong in the United States that that is one of the choices. Europe instead has gone a different way. With concerns on land usage and competition with food production, we can only use waste. Waste oils, waste fats, and other feedstock. So one of the things that we're investing in BP, and we really believe in, which I think might be something that joins the two markets and the requirements of both markets, is cover crops. So this is a novelty. You know, I'm becoming an expert on crops now. So cover crops are crops that go in between the main crops. And so they do not disturb food production, but yet they can be a new feedstock that we can crush and then use to produce renewable fuels, both SAF and renewable diesel. The good part of it is also that it puts nutrition back into the soil. So we're using land that is fallow. We are not interfering. We're not changing the land use. So we're a big believer in this. We have invested in a partnership with Nuseed on a seed called Carinata. So we're developing that and we're looking at other novelty crops. So Europe has already allowed this. And so we think this might be a game changer as we look at future feedstock, because that is essential to give scale up to the industry.
It's so exciting. The idea of cover crops for SAF, novel cover crops for SAF, also helping to simplify the complexity of these different policy regimes. It's truly amazing and baffling how many levels of complexity a company has to navigate to lead in this. And I think continues to reinforce the importance of having companies like BP playing a leadership role there. In addition to complexity around the policy environment, we also have a really complex public perception stakeholder environment. And I want to talk a little bit about this because it's sort of ugly. And I think we don't discuss it as much as we maybe need to, how much resistance there can be among stakeholders for traditional oil and gas companies to participate in these decarbonization solutions. Of course, as you know, Federica, I'm passionate about having traditional companies reinvent themselves in these novel ways. But the reality is that there's been a long history and there's a lot of stakeholders who don't trust oil and gas companies. So I'm just curious, you've worked in this industry your whole career. And I'm curious, what do you wish that traditional energy companies were doing to build more trust with these skeptical stakeholders? Or how do you integrate this into your work?
I can't deny it. I can only acknowledge the resistance that you're talking about. You make me think about this, but the reality is we are committed. As an industry, we are committed at BP. Back in 2020, we announced that we would become net zero by 2050 or sooner. And all of our efforts have started to go into that since then. I am committed. My team is committed. We all are. Just to give you an idea, we said we want to transform ourselves from an international oil and gas company to an integrated energy company. So we want to turn into something different. And that starts with where we are investing. So we are now investing, just switching our investment from our traditional resilient hydrocarbons, which still fund our business, to transition growth engines. So that is bioenergy, renewables, hydrogen, EVs, EV charging and convenience. So we went from around 3% investment in these to 23% in 2023. And our commitment is to get to about 50% of our capex, so of our investment in the transition growth engines by 2030. So that to me is the first demonstration that we are committed and we are putting our money into what's new and into change. We have made some major investment in biofuels. We've invested in Archaea Energy in the US, which produces biogas, is a large producer there. BP Bunge in Brazil, it's a business that we've had actually for a long time, and it's one of the largest producers of ethanol from sugarcane in the Brazilian market. In EV charging, we are growing, just as EV cars are growing. We are at 29,000 charge points, and we'll be going up to 100,000 by 2030. So big rise there. And then there's the old renewable space with offshore wind and solar with Lightsource BP, where we have about 58 gigawatts of pipeline. This is massive. And it's a great achievement if you think where we were just 4 years ago. So my answer to it, how do we deal with that resistance and we gain trust, is show our commitment and keep on delivering. And we are delivering, and eventually we'll gain that trust through delivery.
I couldn't agree more. You're articulating a vision and then proof points to deliver on that vision. And now you have many. And I often advise our audience and our clients, people will say they don't want you, show up anyway. Keep going, keep showing up at the table, keep delivering. And the reason I love working with you, Federica, is because in addition to those proof points, your authenticity shines through, right? When you say, I'm committed, my team's committed, that ultimately will carry the day in building relationships that build trust. And I hear it and I know it to be true. I want to talk a little bit about you as a leader, you as an executive who spent your career in the oil and gas industry. A lot of companies with fewer resources than BP are embarking upon these adventures, and people who come from traditional business like you did are getting put in charge of some kind of new venture. I'm wondering, what advice do you have for those executives? Like, what have you learned along the way that can help other executives now in a position like yours? One that's novel, that's maybe in the spotlight, and that there might not be a playbook for how to succeed at it.
That's an interesting point. First, the basics. I mean, you need to stay in tune with your customers. In the end, is working together, your customers give you your demand, and you need to work in tune for the future. We've worked with the airlines. We fueled our first commercial airline flight with SAF back in 2008. We partner with the airports, actually. That's an interesting part of our job. We are helping the airports lower their carbon emissions and see ways to do that. So you need to stay in tune with your customers and work together. And that goes to collaboration that I was saying before. No one, at this point, the solution is complex and it's multifaceted, and there is not one solution. So it requires all of us to work together and be present in advocacy, participation in trade association, industry association is not a cost, it's an investment. We need to remain present and participate. Maybe I'll switch to something a bit less tangible, but still that I see as fundamental. I think the word that really springs to mind is resilience. So we're dealing with a lot of change, and it's a lot of change externally, but also internally. We have to change our own mindset internally. We have to develop a strategy that remains acutely in tune with the external world. And as we do that, we need to remain humble because we're doing new things. It means that we need to be open to the fact that we will not get it right all the time. Business development, which I've done for a long time, has got a chance of success of 10%. It means that 90% of the time you'll be disappointed. And you need to deal with that by turning yourself into a growth mindset that every opportunity is a learning opportunity, and learn and relearn what could we have done better, how do we improve it next time, and just keep going. Which leads, if you want, to leadership. And I'm not here preaching, there's plenty of people who do it better than me and talk about the leadership that we need in this VUCA world. We have to deal with a lot of uncertainty and a lot of ambiguity. You have technology risk, you have regulatory risk. Over the last few years, it's all been compounded by geopolitical risk. And then we talk a lot about strategic risk because we need to get the pace of the energy transition right. If we invest too early, we risk to strand capital. If we invest too late, we risk to lose competitiveness. So it's just about getting that pace right. And how do you do that? In the end, I'm a big believer in empowering teams and developing teams that are independent, working agile, that can think, because that's the best way that we have to remain agile and remain in tune with the external world and also understand the factor outside. If our assumptions are failing, the quicker we found out, the easier we can correct the course of action. And so that can help us to understand whether we're investing in the right things or the wrong things and correct as we go. We need a diverse workforce as well. You talked about creativity. We need creativity in all aspects of what we're doing. And that comes with diversity of thought. And to develop diversity of thought, you need psychological safety. You need teams that work, that collaborate. So all of that, to me, is the new leadership that we need, because in the end, it's not one brain, it's the power of the collective brain that's going to deliver change.
You're going to have a lot of resumes filling your inbox, Federica. That was very compelling. I'm resisting the urge to ask you for a job right now. There's so much in there that is meaningful and also clearly heartfelt that I love. The particularly unique thing I've never heard before, but it's so obvious when you say it, is getting the pace of this transition right. And that really sort of encompasses all of this, right? In the pace, needing to have the empowered teams, needing to have the creativity, needing to be able to fail and get up and keep going. I really loved so many insights in that piece. Let me just get one more take from you based on your experience. You've worked in natural gas. You've worked in LNG and power, and now you have this aviation exposure and, of course, your new expertise in cover crops. I'm wondering, when you look at this amazing industry that we work in, what are you keeping an eye on? What are the areas that you're excited about? What do you think is going to catch your eye next?
Sustainable aviation fuel, which obviously is number one. The second one is a bit personal, is electric vehicle. I used to live in Houston, Texas, and back in 2016, we bought our first EV. And it was so much novelty that, you know, sometimes people would stop and take a picture of it, you know, when the car was parked in the car park. That was how new it was. And now here we are 8 years later. And if I look out of the window here from my house, I see electric vehicle passing by. They become normal. And, you know, I have teenage daughters. My husband and I always joke that probably it's reality. They're never going to drive a combustion engine car. They're going to learn to drive with an electric car. And probably, you know, if they drive a combustion engine, it's going to be, open quote, to try the ancient generation ways, you know, close quote, because obviously we're ancient. So really excited about seeing how fast that has grown. If you read our energy outlook, we forecast that there will be 2 billion EVs by 2050. So that's a growth rate of 32% year on year. So it's massive. What I like about it is because the world has changed in front of our eyes so fast. And it's positive. And it's going into the right direction. And I think eventually we'll get, you know, it's at a different pace in different countries. Obviously, London maybe is not the same as other parts of the world, but it's coming. And it's becoming easier also with super fast chargers. So we are putting electric vehicles on the airports, of course, because we like them. So we got our first EV refueler, which has been nicknamed EV for obvious reasons, which also won us an award last year in Australia. We won a sustainability award for the best initiative of the year, which made us all proud. And I was in Brisbane back in January and I got to ride in it. So we're very proud of that. So now we're moving forward with that as well.
It's wonderful to hear at a time where there's sort of a generic skepticism around EV adoption to keep in mind the momentum underway. And I have never thought of my internal combustion engine being referred to as like a retro car, you know, like the old, like, oh, you old fogey and your ice. So such a great way to contemplate how fast the change is happening. So I have a final question for you, Federica, that I ask all my guests. What are you most optimistic about?
I'm an optimist by nature. And probably, I don't know, maybe it's because I'm an engineer. I'm a firm believer in progress. The world is changing around us. And I think as a human species, we actually have a talent to deliver change and adapt. We don't like it because I think it's not in our nature actually to like change. We have a natural resistance to change. But then history has demonstrated to us that we actually are a very adaptable species. And so if you look at our history, it's a history of progress. Yes, sometimes with setbacks, sometimes at different pace, but it's been progress nonetheless. And when it comes to the energy transition, I see exactly the same. The direction of travel has been set, and I don't see us going back at this point. The pace will be determined, you know, by a lot of factors, technology, policy, we talked about, economic and social factors for sure. But in the end, there will be bumps in the road, but it's all onwards and upwards from now on. So I am a real optimist that change is happening and that I can be part of change, honestly. We at BP can be part of this change. And wherever I go in the world, sustainability is always in the conversation. And really, wherever I go in the world, we talk about sustainable aviation fuel. We talk about how to lower the carbon emission of the airport. And it's not just Western world or the Northern Hemisphere. This is really now on the agenda everywhere. And that gives me a lot of optimism.
Well, your optimism is infectious, and I want to thank you on behalf of my team, but also our listeners, because I imagine everyone's leaving with a little boost today. So, Federica, thank you so much for joining me on the Energy Thinks podcast.
Thank you so much.
That's our episode for today. Thanks so much to Federica Barra for joining me. I really found compelling the way that Federica talked about leadership. And she didn't say that courage is required, but she conveyed the kind of courage that I think all of us have to have in doing this really challenging work. I'd like to know what you found interesting. I hope you'll reach out to us at energythinks.com. If you enjoy what you're hearing, please take a moment to rate and review us. It helps others in the oil and gas industry find this podcast. Thank you to Kayla Chives for making Energy Thinks possible. Until next time, I'm Tisha Schuler, wishing you and yours happiness, prosperity, and good health.